remember all of the stuff after that, this little interlude. Remember Leon Jaworski, remember Nixon, remember the unifications, connections to both, recall the connections of both Nixon and Jaworski to the assassination of President Kennedy. And we'll also, before we get into another aspect of the Unification Church, it might be worth mentioning also that in another Radio Free America broadcast in which we dealt with Messrs. Wilson and Turple, the, quote, ex-unquote CIA agents, it was mentioned by Frank Turple that Edwin Wilson had connections with Tongs and Park and that they had, in fact, worked quite closely together. That information is corroborated, by the way, in a current book which has some information about Watergate called Secret Agenda by a man named Jim Hogan, whose book Spooks we're going to touch on in just a second. Now, another organization which figures both in connection with the Moonies and in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy is something called the World Anti-Communist League. And the World Anti-Communist League is currently chaired by a fellow by the name of John Singlaub, an American general, a former general of ultra-right-wing persuasion. And two names that we're going to be looking at in connection with the Unification Church are a couple of former Japanese war criminals named Roichi Sasakawa and Yoshio Kodama. Both men mentioned in Gifts of Deceit as follows. In 1969, Moon decided it was time to get his rank and file in America busy combating communism. He had been waging extensive anti-communist campaigns in Korea and Japan under the aegis of his International Federation for the Extermination of Communism, with political and financial support from Roichi Sasakawa, R-O-R-Y-O-I-C-H-I-S-A-S-A-K-A-W-A, and Yoshio Kodama, Y-O-S-H-I-O-K-O-D-A-M-A. Beginning that sentence again. He had been waging extensive anti-communist campaigns in Korea and Japan under the aegis of his International Federation for the Extermination of Communism, with political and financial support from Roichi Sasakawa and Yoshio Kodama and other powerful Japanese right-wing figures. He organized the Freedom League, Freedom Leadership Foundation, the FLF, the American branch of his International Federation. Its president, Alan Tate Wood, mobilized Moonie groups throughout the country to lobby for the hawk position in Vietnam and to try and defuse the peace movement. Wood and eight other American Moonie leaders attended the annual conference of the World Anti-Communist League in Kyoto, Japan in September of 1970. The conference was the biggest ever held by the World League, largely because the sponsoring organization that year was a Moon group, Shokyo Rengo, S-H-O-K-Y-O-R-E-N-G-O, the Japanese branch of his International Anti-Communist Federation. Master ordered the Japanese Moonies to prepare for the event with a massive fundraising drive, which reportedly yielded $1.4 million brought in by selling flowers in the streets. Through the KCFF, the Moon organization was able to engage Senator Strom Thurmond as guest speaker. Of course, Strom Thurmond very much on the scene today, and another, I couldn't call him a figure on the new right, but one of the linchpins of the old right who has lingered to this day. Now, before we proceed here with these two Japanese war criminals, again, very much affiliated with the Moonies, let's review the connection of the World Anti-Communist League to the assassination of President Kennedy.
One of the most interesting events in the story of the assassination of John F. Kennedy was, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald's visit to Russia. This has been talked about a great deal, and yet quite a few of the details of the visit itself and Lee Harvey Oswald's return are not talked about quite so much. One of the things that is not mentioned is, again, the entire Warren Commission thesis is based on the fact that it's largely hung on the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald is some kind of a disaffected leftist. Well, there are numerous accounts of Lee Harvey Oswald's right-wing connections of various sorts and types. One of the interesting examples is that the only person, okay, Lee Harvey Oswald was at the Atsugi Naval Air Base in Japan, defected to Russia, supposedly taking with him secrets that he threatened to give to the Russians about America's most important defense systems. Yet after Lee Harvey Oswald had spent quite some time in Russia and came back, the only people who met him, there was no official deprogramming of Lee Harvey Oswald, no official people coming to meet him and see what he had been up to, this supposed enemy of the country, this leftist who defected with naval air secrets to Russia. The only person who met him was a representative of Traveler's Aid by the name of Spaz T. Rakin, kind of an unusual name, S-P-A-A-S-T, and then Rakin, last name, R-A-I-K-I-N. Spas Rakin was, yes, representing Travelers Aid. He also happened to be representing the World Anti-Communist League, of which he was a prominent member. So the person who actually came to meet Lee Harvey Oswald was indeed a leading member of the World Anti-Communist League.
He was also, by the way, that Friends of the League of Anti-Bolshevik Nations was one of the organizations that Spas T. Rakin was affiliated with, and that was affiliated, among other things, with the Galen organization. So, again, a Galen connection to the World Anti-Communist League, to Lee Harvey Oswald, and to this whole tangle of events running through the assassination of President Kennedy, Watergate, Koreagate, and on up to the El Camino, where they all sell flowers as we drive along.
That's right. So poor Lee Harvey Oswald, lost leftist, comes back from the Soviet Union, and who is there to give him coffee and donuts but a representative of the World Anti-Communist League, who, as we all know, spend a great deal of their time out helping lost and disaffected leftists on the streets and bringing them things to eat and welcoming them back to the United States.
Particularly when these leftists have betrayed the United States officially.
With military secrets, indeed. Okay, we've got a great deal more to go just on Yoshio Kodama and a bit on Ryuichi Sasakawa. However, you folks have been sitting there, those of you who are listening, have been sitting there listening for about an hour and 45 minutes, and we have been similarly sitting for about an hour and 45 minutes. So we are going to take a short break, about 6-7 minutes duration. Confused, we're just casual here. Good evening, this is Nip Tuck back with you in the studios with Dave Aaron. And just to remind you that we are here, we've been sort of thrust untimely into a slightly different studio, and we're not quite sure necessarily of everything that's going on. It's not a new studio, actually. It's the old studio, but we haven't used it for several months. So we're kind of fiddling around here with things and moving things. So there'll be some occasional little flaws in the air sound. We know that those of you out there who are loyal enough to listen to this kind of stuff will just look right past it. Anyway, what did I want to mention else? I think that's about it, basically. We're going to go back to the subject at hand, and as you remember, when we stopped before the break, and by the way, I should mention for those of you who are just tuning in and don't know what's going on, that what you're listening to is a Radio Free America archive broadcast. This is the third part of our series on mind control. We're dealing specifically with cults tonight. We've already talked about Jonestown, and we're in the middle of talking about the Moonies and their various political connections. One of the things, of course, we're doing is tracing the political connections of some of these specific cults, and in these cases, all of the ones we're talking about have some kind of connection directly into not only in national security establishment, but also back to the Axis, that being, of course, the German and Japanese Axis and Italian, et cetera, during World War II. So, anyway, without further ado, let me just tell you again, you are listening to Radio Free America. This is Nip Tuck here with Dave Emery, and this is KF.
Now, recall that all of the political machinations that we've been covering really should be set against the tapestry of mind control, because all of these organizations that we're touching on, Jonestown, the Unification Church, the Ananda Marga group that we're going to be discussing in just a few minutes, essentially have been charged by or definitely established as performing mind control of one sort or another on their adherents, okay? Now recall that with the Unification Church, its roots go back to Imperial Japan, Fascist Japan, the country that we fought in the Pacific Theater during World War II. Korea was a Japanese colony. All of the key figures in the Korean National Security Establishment after World War II had originally trained as part of the Fascist Japanese National Security Establishment. We were taking a look at a couple of fellows named Ryuichi Sasakawa and Yoshio Kodama, and we're going to go into both of those, the careers of both of those individuals, particularly Yoshio Kodama, at some length in just a minute. Before evaluating Yoshio Kodama's efforts, I think it's important to discuss a little bit of the history of how fascism came to Japan. And the main thing we're going to focus on now are the working of the so-called patriotic societies. Now, we'll cover this information in some detail on a future Radio Free America broadcast, probably one dealing with the origins of fascism, how fascism came to be established in the Axis nations. But we'd like to give you a thumbnail synopsis of it right now. Basically, the fascist government of Japan, the one against which we fought in World War II, came to power exactly as the fascist government of Germany did, through a program of assassinations. The legitimate political leadership of Japan was systematically wiped out through a series of very clumsy and quite overt political assassinations. These assassinations were carried out by a number of different groups, primarily what are known as the Patriotic Societies. Now, the Patriotic Societies were a major organ of Japanese nationalism and militarism during the early part of the 20th century, actually the late part of the 19th century as well. They also functioned as espionage organizations, both inside Japan and abroad. Now, the Patriotic Societies were composed of a loose association of criminals, underworld entrepreneurs, thugs, strong-armed men. They were very heavily infiltrated by the military as well, though. Military cadets played a very important role in the Patriotic Societies and in the assassination program, which paved the way for fascism to arrive in Japan. Now, the Patriotic Societies, as I said, their relationship with the military is incestuous. The military infiltrates the Patriotic Societies, and it also manipulates those very same societies. The assassination program, primarily carried out by the Patriotic Societies, eliminates the legitimate political leadership of Japan and paves the way for fascism to come to that country. A good book which sums up the it describes in detail the workings of the Patriotic Societies, in particular their role in assassinating the legitimate Japanese political leadership. An excellent book was authored by a man named Hugh Bias, last name B-Y-A-S. His book, published in 1942, was called Government by Assassination. Before reading a little bit of that book, I'd like to give you a little bit on Hugh Bias's background. It says on the back of Government by Assassination, Hugh Bias was born in Scotland, had his early training on Scottish country newspapers, and joined the staff of the London Times in 1909. 5 years later, he went to Tokyo to edit the Japan Advertiser, an independent American daily. He remained there all through World War I when Japan was our ally and until 1922. At that time, he went back to London, but 4 years later, he returned to Tokyo as correspondent for the London Times, and the following year became representative of the New York Times as well. When he left Tokyo in April of 1941 on the second-to-last mail steamer, he was the dean of the foreign correspondents in that city and had seen their number grow from the original 3 to more than 60, half of whom were Germans. So that's who the fellow is whose expertise we're going to rely on here. His book, once again, called Government by Assassination, copyrighted in 1942 by Alfred A. Knopf and Company. And I'd like to read you a short section of the jacket which will sum up the working of the Japanese Patriotic Societies with regard to the assassination program which brought fascism to Japan. Bias writes as follows. Well, actually, this is from the Overleaf and to Hugh Bias's book, Government by Assassination. It sort of sums up the thesis of the whole book, and we will delve into this book at some length in the future. Only a man who lived in Japan for 23 years and could produce this sensational revelation of the secret power of the Japanese militarists. Anyway, here is the truth about the patriotic murder societies, the army gangsters, the army's idea of Japan's destiny, and the strange role of the emperor. In Japan, the army possesses a kind of autonomy which immunizes it from control by any other agency. Long ago, Mr. Bias saw that the intoxication of this immunity would lead to war, and so he spent many years ferreting out from the secretive Japanese how the militarists gained their fantastic power. His book, therefore, is to Japan what Rauschning's Revolution of Nihilism was to Germany. Starting from the grassroots of Japanese politics, it moves steadily toward the amazing disclosure of principles. At bottom, the Japanese army is closely allied with gangsterism. The so-called patriotic societies which do its dirty work are nothing more than leagues of murderers, blackmailers, and thieves. Bias shows how these terrorists made contact years ago with certain groups of appreciative younger officers, and how consequently almost every civilian leader who curbed the army's power was assassinated. So basically, the Japanese patriotic societies, through this assassination program at the behest of the military and using gangsters, bring fascism to Japan. They also serve as a very, very important organ of foreign intelligence. Okay, the secret societies are one of the main, and not only the assassination wing, which brings militarism to power, they are also a prime ideological generating force. They helped generate the swing to militarism that overtook Japan. They also serve as a very powerful overseas espionage organization, and that's one of the places we're going to pick them up right now. Now, Basically, Niptuck's going to read you a little bit from a book about the Japanese intelligence service, and you cannot divorce the workings of the patriotic societies in any way from the workings of Japanese espionage.
Okay, this teeny section which I'm going to read from, although we will read a little bit more from this book later on, is from a book called Kempeitai, spelled K-E-M-P-E-I-T-A-I. That was the Japanese Secret Service, and the book is subheaded A History of the Japanese Secret Service. The book was written by Richard Deacon, published in paperback by Berkeley Books of New York, first published in paperback in 1983. Okay, just a short section here, and just a name in particular that we're going to want you to hold on to for later reference, and then we're going to go on to Yoshio Kodama and his involvement with these particular groups. But this first segment, we just want you to note one thing, reading from the book. Secret societies actively engaged in intelligence gathering for their country proliferated throughout the 20s and 30s and made an invaluable contribution to Japan's need for a worldwide network. As these societies took varying forms, it was easy for one or other of them to search out such likely recruits as Trebitch Lincoln, who's a man they've just talked about a little earlier, the two Boses, B-O-S-E, Bose, the two Boses and other malcontents who could be won over to a cleverly painted portrait of a prosperous Asia under Japanese protection and guidance. Okay, Bose is the key name here, a man named Subhash Chandra Bose that we're going to be talking about a little later in the broadcast, and we will get to in a moment.
So now, we're going to go back to Yoshio Kodama, who was a key figure in the Japanese patriotic societies, also very much involved with the Moonies and the World Anti-Communist League. So as you hear about Kodama, recall his affiliation with the Japanese patriotic societies and their three-pronged role. First of all, as the prime generator of Japanese ultranationalism and militarism, as the actual organ of assassination which brought that militarism and nationalism to power, it actually empowered that philosophy, and as a powerful organ of overseas intelligence for Imperial Japan.
Yeah, and to make, again, a rather broad political point that needs to be made every now and then, bear in mind that this is a man who was an ultranationalist, right-wing Japanese, a very wealthy industrialist who got involved with a variety of things, and to this day, as far as I know, although he may have finally died, but his...
He died this year,
That's right. Okay, that's what I thought. But right up until his death was involved in such things as shipping millions of dollars to the United States to be used by the Moonies for things like the Washington Times. Well, it'd be used specifically for the Washington Times. Now, this is a man who basically was a right-wing fanatic who supported the Japanese fascist regime, the same Japanese fascist regime that was slaughtering people all over Asia and later slaughtering United States troops all over the Pacific. And again, we see after the United States and the Allied powers come in after World War II that these people are basically put back on the street to the point where they can go on to influence United States public opinion 40 years after the war. Okay, we're going to be reading from Spooks by James Hogan, a book that we have recommended a great deal on this show. An excellent book, a very complex book that covers a whole lot of different subjects, but one that if you can have the patience to sit and get about 50 pages into it, you will find yourself so caught up that you will not want to put it down. Hogan, by the way, is spelled H-O-U-G-A-N, and the edition we have published, William Morrow and Company, 1978. Hogan also just came out with a book just a couple of weeks ago called The Hidden Agenda.
Secret Agenda. Which mentions the Tongson Park Ed Wilson connection that we spoke about a little while ago.
Okay. Hogan writes as follows. An ultranationalist and terrorist leader at 15, Kodama, self-same Yoshio Kodama, immersed himself in the political bedlam of Depression Japan, joining an even score of conspiratorial societies with such names as the Blood Brotherhood, Holy War Execution League, Federation of Radical Patriotic Workers, and the Capital Rise Asia Academy. These societies, many of them murderous and fly-by-night affairs, provided him with a precarious living. Ostensibly political, they were often no more than street gangs manipulated for private ends by wealthy industrialists, the police, and the army. They fought the communists and one another with equal frequency and underwent a continual factionalization. Often the societies consisted of no more than a dozen friends, a post office box, and stolen gelignite. It was in this right-wing milieu, part underworld and part underground, that Kodama plotted to conduct a battle of the Emperor's entourage, a state massacre that would eliminate at one stroke all the most powerful men in the realm. A premature explosion led the plot awry, however, and Kodama found himself beginning the first in a series of prison terms meted out to him for his terrorist activities. Molding himself into the image of a 20th century samurai, devoting himself to the martial arts and traditional Buddhist meditation practices, the young Kodama refined his political beliefs as well. By 1940, he'd forged a peculiar ideology, combining elements of fascism with those of Japanese feudalism. He'd also forged powerful links to Japan's military intelligence apparatus, carrying out numerous secret missions to Manchuria. As a reward for his intelligence work, he was entrusted with the task of supplying the Japanese Navy in wartime. Establishing the Kodama Kikan, or Kodama Agency, he built a financial empire from a handful of rooms in Shanghai's Shin Asia Hotel. According to formerly secret reports of the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps, Kodama accomplished the Navy's ends at gunpoint, taking hostages and forcing Chinese villagers to sell him the goods he demanded. Paying a pittance to the Chinese, he then resold the goods at fabulous profit to the Imperial Navy. Systematically looting China of its raw materials, he amassed a personal fortune of colossal dimensions. To accomplish that, he acquired heroin on the black market in Tokyo, traded it for tungsten in Shanghai, sold the tungsten for yen, used the yen to buy guns, sold the guns in Borneo for gold, exchanged the gold for industrial diamonds, and in the meantime cornered the Shanghai radium market by emptying the hospitals of their supplies. In addition, he operated salt mines, iron mines, farms, fisheries, an orphanage, a molybdenum mine, and secret munitions factories throughout central China. In his heroin deals, he sometimes burned the consumer, and there were unproven allegations that the yen spent in China was counterfeit. Not that it mattered, since it was useless to the Chinese in any case. He came to be regarded as, quote, the man behind the Kempeitai, or secret police, financing its Shanghai office in return for its, quote, physical support. Intelligence reports show that this was sometimes bloody work, revealing that Kodama was suspected of assassinating his partner and of taking part in a massacre of Chinese at the Shin Asia Hotel.
And before continuing with Hogan's narrative here, recall the things that we're looking at here. An underworld entrepreneur trading in, among other things, heroin, and using the proceeds from this underworld business empire to finance the Japanese Secret Service, the Kempeitai, the Japanese Intelligence Service. This is a pattern that we're going to see, this combination of underworld business entrepreneurship and intelligence is a long-standing pattern, and one that we've looked at in the past and are going to look at again in the future. Continuing with Hogan's narrative from Spooks, at war's end, the 34-year-old was a brigadier general, a cabinet advisor, and the possessor of a financial hoard that included a room full of platinum, sacks of industrial diamonds, an undetermined amount of foreign currency, and upward of 3.5 billion yen, not including liquid assets. Just how much Kodama was worth, however, could not be exactly ascertained. All documents of the Kodama Kikan were burned at the end of the war, and Kodama himself admits that he hid most of his wealth. Imprisoned as a war crime suspect in 1946, note that, he'd been attempting to organize a new political party for Japan, a party in naked emulation of those that govern the United States. This democratic pretense, however, failed to deceive American occupation authorities. An intelligence assessment of Kodama concludes, quote, in summary, Kodama appears to be a man doubly dangerous. His long and fanatic involvement in ultra-nationalistic activities, violence included, and his skill in appealing to youth make him a man who, if released from internment, would surely be a grave security risk. In addition, there is the outstanding probability to be reckoned with that, as a result of his hearty cooperation with the war effort, he has a large fortune to back up whatever activities he might see fit to undertake. His success in the difficulties of securing supplies in wartime for the Navy mark him as one who could very easily become a big-time operator in Japan's reconstruction period. Persistent rumors as to his black market profits in his Shanghai period, plus his known opportunism, are forceful arguments that he would be as unscrupulous in trade as he was in ultranationalism. Kodama's past performance indicates that he is the sort of man G2 considers more dangerous than either the superannuated ideologists or the professional men who aided Japan's wartime effort for reasons of patriotism or survival of their professional interests. Dangerous potentialities for the future. Another report, prepared by Kodama's chief inquisitor, Lieutenant Frank O'Neill, concludes, quote, I am satisfied that Kodama or his associates, for whom he is responsible, committed numerous acts of violence in China in the acquisition by foul means or fair of commodities and goods belonging to the Chinese. Shortly after this assessment was made, and in spite of it, Kodama was released without trial. Walking out of prison with him was Nobusuke Kishi, a future prime minister, and 17 other war crime suspects who would become the financial and political spine of a new democratic Japan. By the way, Nobusuke Kishi's last name was K-I-S-H-I. Why was Kodama released? The last pages of his diary give a clue. Quote, "Who, in this age of ideological confusion, is capable of bringing the laboring masses, influenced completely by communist ideals and rampaging like a wounded beast, under control? The bestial roar of the Communist Party reaches into my cell through the barred windows of Sugamo Prison. I can hear the dull thud of the marching feet of thousands of communists advancing towards the Bolshevization of Japan. Who will fight the last fight with them? Behind the steel bars of Sugamo, this young life of mine, burning with the passionate ardor of a love of my country and of justice, strains against the bars that hold it in," unquote. A few days after Kodama's release, Lieutenant Frank O'Neill was reported to have predicted, quote, "10 years from today, this man Kodama is going to be a great leader of Japan," unquote. He was right. Working behind the scenes, Kodama established the Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP, using funds hoarded from his Shanghai days. It soon became the most important political party in Asia, leading some to suspect that Kodama's release from Sugamo had been engineered by the fledgling CIA. Whether that is so or not, Kodama rapidly consolidated his hold over Japan's ultra-nationalists and re-established contact with anti-communist gangsters and street punks from the Tokyo Ginza. Before long, his flunkies would brag in print of his role behind the scenes, describing him as, quote, "the driving force," unquote, in Japanese politics. Before we continue with the narrative here, I think it might be worthwhile to just ruminate over what we just read for a second or two. Now here, Yoshio Kodama is able to make the transition from being basically a defeated imperialist, a Japanese war criminal. Remember, he was imprisoned on suspicion of having committed war crimes in China. And basically, he is the man behind the Kempei Tai and the fellow who is able to basically become the chief procurement officer, I guess you could call it, for the Japanese Navy. Now, his underworld activities, intimately and inextricably bound up with his activities as a Japanese intelligence agent, basically provide him with enough funds to begin his post-war career. So there is something of a question about the continuity between Yoshio Kodama's underground activities on behalf of Japanese intelligence during World War II and his post-war revival as one of the main forces in the, quote, new, unquote, Japanese politics, and that perhaps his elevation and release from prison took place with the aid of the CIA. And as Niptuck noted earlier in the broadcast, again, we see the United States turning to fascists, previous enemies and newly defeated enemies, in order to basically further its anti-communist goals in this poor portion of the world. But in particular, keep in mind the possibility here that Hogan suggests that profits and assets acquired during his role, his wartime role as a Japanese intelligence agent and underground entrepreneur, financed, at least to some extent, his post-war rise as a major political force in the new Japan.
Also, since we're going to see, as we've heard to an extent already, and will be covered more a little bit, Kodama becomes a power within the Unification Church, specifically in Japan. It's interesting, again, to note his beginnings in the trade of guns and drugs. As we've talked about another One Step Beyond, there have been numerous allegations now that the Unification Church has many contacts in the East, in Asia right now, in much the same way that the United States security establishment has, that are themselves involved in peddling drugs, and that several of the United States client governments or sub-governments in Asia of the right-wing persuasion are involved in drug peddling. And the Moonies, the Unification Church, has been doing, among other things, a propaganda campaign for many years for some of these groups to explain why that whatever they do, it's okay, we shouldn't worry about them peddling drugs because they're, after all, fighting communism. So the activities that originally made Yoshio Kodama rich are still being justified by the Unification Church and, of course, under the behind the scenes by our own intelligence establishment.
Now recall, of course, the many powerful individuals and the many important American political organizations touched or influenced by the Moonies, because, again, we're going back to the Japanese war criminals. We're going back to the people who bombed Pearl Harbor. And if that sounds like a bit of hyperbole, in the passage Niptuck's about to read you, we're going to see some actual connections between these people and the people who literally planned the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Continuing on with Hogan's narrative, indeed by 1958, Kodama was again one of the most powerful men in the Orient, almost as influential in Korea as he was in Japan. In that year, he signed the first of many contracts with the Lockheed Corporation, promising to reverse Japan's decision to outfit its born-again Air Force with Grumman F-11Fs. To accomplish that reversal, he relied upon a bizarre cast that included an American-born espionage agent who'd lost his citizenship by working for the Japanese in occupied Manchuria, another spook who'd plied his trade in southern China, a politician who was later jailed for embezzlement, an extreme right-wing publisher, various war crimes suspects who'd shared the anxieties of Sugamo, and the architect of Pearl Harbor, General Minoru Genda. Appointed commander-in-chief of the Japanese Air Force, through the backing of Kodama and Kishi, then prime minister-in-chief of the National Defense Council, and you remember that Kishi was being held at Sugamo with Yoshio Kodama, and walked at the same time. Minoru Genda was wildly enthusiastic about the Lockheed Starfighter. After testing it in California, he returned to Japan with a recommendation that only the Starfighter would do. At about the same time, Genda's recommendation was echoed by a special delegation of German Air Force officers, including General Günther Rahl, who'd arrived in Tokyo to persuade recalcitrant Japanese of the Starfighter's dubious superiority. Supported then by Japan's most honored military figure, by its respected ally in the preceding war, by the Prime Minister, and by Kodama's political manipulations, Lockheed accomplished the impossible. Grumman's contract evaporated. A few months later, after the Lockheed contract was signed, General Genda was awarded the U.S. Legion of Merit by the American Air Force, 17 years after he'd annihilated its planes in Hawaii. I want to just go back over that one more time so you can see the wonders of history. A few months later, after the Lockheed contract was signed, General Minoru Genda was awarded the U.S. Legion of Merit by the American Air Force, 17 years after this man had put together the annihilation of the American Naval Air Force at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. How fast times change. Indeed, 1958 was a busy year for Kodama. Besides the difficulty of engineering the Lockheed sale, he was called upon to preserve the disintegrating political position of Prime Minister Kishi. Regarded by many as an American puppet for having pushed an unpopular Japanese-American security treaty through the Diet, of course, is the Japanese parliament, Kishi appeared to be on the way out. Kodama, however, was able to save him, rallying the right wing to his standard and provoking street demonstrations in his behalf. Those demonstrations were countered by even larger ones organized by the left, and it appeared that President Eisenhower's impending visit to Japan would result in widespread bloodshed. With the demos gathering force, U.S. and Japanese authorities called upon Kodama to take charge of Operation Protect Ike. Moving with customary quiet, the former assassin pried loose an estimated $2,300,000 in, quote, contributions from local businessmen, ultranationalists, and racketeers. With that in hand, he hired platoons of anti-communist street fighters, providing them with riot gear, trucks, and helicopters. At the last minute, however, Ike's visit was aborted, as American authorities contemplated what appeared to be the makings of a massacre. Sometime after the mooting of Operation Protect Ike, Kodama seems to have joined the Unification Church, gravitating toward that organization through the auspices of Ryuichi Sasakawa. He spells it here Sasagawa with a G. We've seen it both ways. An old friend of Kodama's, a veteran of Sugamo, in other words, the prison where the suspected war criminals are being held, and the Shanghai-Manchuria intrigue, Sasagawa came into enormous wealth after the war, becoming, among many other things, chairman of the Japan Shipbuilding Association. An ultranationalist whose views paralleled Kodama's, Sasakawa established himself in his friend's mold, becoming one of Japan's leading kurumaku, which means black curtain, which comes from the kabuki drama and refers to the curtain that hangs at the back of the stage and hides people who hand out a lot of the props and things like that, and do the voices, too. In other words, somebody behind the scenes. Just as Kodama privately financed military exercises on the remote island of Choju, Sasakawa lavished money on Tokyo's martial arts societies, a euphemism that might cover everything from karate clubs to paramilitary cabals. Sasakawa's pet project, however, was win over communism, WOC, a fundraising subsidiary of the Unification Church. Sasakawa served as WOC's chairman and Kodama as its chief advisor. This needn't indicate any special religiosity on the part of either man. On the contrary, the Unification Church's evangelical anti-communism is a bulwark of South Korean stability, and as such, protective of Kodama's investments in that country. Still, the implications of Kodama's relationship to WOC and the allegedly Reverend Sun Myung-moon are interesting to ponder. The recipient of untold Lockheed millions, Kodama was the aircraft firm's agent in both Japan and Korea. Other corporations, notably Gulf, have been shaken down for, quote, political contributions by Korea's Park regime, the quid pro quo being the right to do business there. It's almost incredible that Kodama, with his influence and investments in South Korea, should not have provided Park's minions with support, financial and otherwise. If he did, then his affiliation with WOC is particularly suggestive. Specifically, it raises the specter of the Lockheed Corporation subsidizing the Moonies' spread from Seoul to Savannah by means of bribes laundered through Hong Kong by an apostate Spanish missionary, see below, this is somebody they're going to talk about later, for delivery in so-called beacons boxes to the industry's Kurumaku in Tokyo. Okay, let me just read that last again, because this is going to be made clear in the part that Dave is going to, I believe in the part you're going to read.
Well,
are we skipping over that?
Yeah, well, yeah, we're going to skip over this part, and so this I think will sort of wind things up for Kodama. I think we should recap, because we're not going to leave the Japanese patriotic societies. However, we are going to move on from the Moonies to another organization with roots going back to the Japanese patriotic societies. Again, among all the organizations, to take a look, I should say, at all of the powerful organizations and people that are connected to the Unification Church. Here, Hogan suggests rather directly that the Lockheed Corporation had a great deal to do with the spreading of Yoshio Kodama and Sasakawa's Moonie influences. Okay, so the Lockheed Corporation, of course, is a major U.S. defense contractor. It is the largest employer here in the Santa Clara Valley, and very possibly connected to the Unification Church through Kodama and Sasakawa. In fact, definitely connected to the Unification Church through Kodama and Sasakawa. And again, recall that these people, Kodama and Sasakawa, of the World Anti-Communist League and the Unification Church, are essentially Japanese war criminals. They fought against the United States, and recall Kodama's connections to Mr. Genda, the fellow who planned the attack on Pearl Harbor. And again, think about the fact that these are people who did not think twice about attacking the United States and taking American lives, and here they are involved with this organization, the Unification Church, which is nothing if not totalitarian in its character. And think about the connections between the Japanese fascists and the Unification Church, and the Unification Church's connections to so many different aspects of American society. And in particular, I can't emphasize the point strongly enough, as you drive down the El Camino on a sunny day, you see all these people smiling and waving and selling flowers and so forth. Virtually all of those people are Moonies. And one of the things, by the way, that Moon teaches his followers is to lie, if anybody asks, if you're connected with the Unification Church. So as you see these smiling little people waving the flowers, you just think about the Arizona going up at Pearl Harbor, because there is a direct connection between the two, okay? And in particular, a thought that I'll toss out to you here, and you can consider this as we go through the broadcast, and perhaps if we have time for phone calls at the end, you can respond to this. But consider the Unification Church as basically an analog of the Japanese patriotic societies. Recall that they not only served as an espionage arm, they committed assassinations, and they also were a prime generative force of the nationalism and militarism which propelled Japan into World War II. Interestingly enough, the man Robert Beecher, who wrote the book Gifts of Deceit, the House staffer who wrote the book Gifts of Deceit that we relied on heavily for our information on the Unification Church, died in a very mysterious fall in this past May. He apparently, at the ripe old age of 44, suffered a fatal injury in a fall from the roof of his New York apartment house, where he was working as a director or working in connection with the Harlem Dance Theater. So Mr. Beecher is no longer on the scene, having departed at the untimely age of 44. So again, consider the possibility, and we're only tossing this out in a speculative way, but consider the possibility of comparing the Unification Church and also the Ananda Marga group that we're going to talk about with the Japanese patriotic societies. One perhaps could think of them as a successor to those societies operating in the United States and in conjunction with it. I'd like to go back for just a second to the book that Nip Tuck read you a short section of a while ago. The book is called Kempei Tai, K-E-M-P-E-I, T-A-I is the second word, subtitled A History of the Japanese Secret Service, authored by Richard Deacon. Now, in here, Richard Deacon goes back to the most, is going to talk about, I should say, the most important of the Japanese patriotic societies that paved the way for fascism in Japan and World War II. The most important of all of those societies was called the Black Dragon Society. That organization derived its name from the Amur River, which provides the borderline between Russia, or now the Soviet Union, and China. Amur, I believe, means Black Dragon in Chinese. Now, the Black Dragon Society had served as a vehicle for Japanese espionage against Russia even before it became the Soviet Union, and then after the Bolshevik Revolution, it continued to function in the same fashion and was the major organ of Japanese espionage against the Soviet Union. It also was the single most important of the Japanese patriotic societies, and, its influence in the rise of fascism to Japan could not be overemphasized. The two names that we want to know here are a guy named Roi Yoshida. He was the head of the Black Dragon Society when it was working towards World War II, and also a fellow named Mitsuru Toyama, last name T-O-Y-A-M-A. Mitsuru Toyama, or Mitsuri Toyama, as he's referred to here, founded the Black Dragon Society and remained its sort of patron throughout, even when Yoshida took over the active functioning of it. And it's worth noting that the Black Dragon Society was directly connected to the German Nazi Party through a fellow named Don Gatto, who was a Nazi press correspondent in Tokyo. Anyway, in Kempei Tai, Richard Deacon writes of the Black Dragon Society as follows. The Black Dragon Society increased numerically in all-around strength and in political influence in the 1920s and 30s. Dominated by Roi Yoshida, the society laid down its policy as follows. Quote, "We shall renovate the present system, foster a foreign policy aiming at expansion overseas, revolutionize domestic policies to increase the happiness of the people, and establish a social policy that will settle problems between labor and capital." And a little farther down, he writes, "The Black Dragon Society was in many respects empirical, that's E-M-P-I-R-I-C-A-L, in outlook as well as chauvinistic. It was just as interested in left-wing revolutionaries as in right-wing reactionaries or muddle-headed liberals, if any of these could be exploited to aid the cause of Japanese expansion. An Indian terrorist who had long campaigned against the British, Rash Bahari Bose, last name B-O-S-E, fled to Japan in 1915 and was befriended by Mitsuru Toyama." Recall, Toyama was the founder and patron of the Black Dragon Society, the single most important individual affiliated with it. Continuing, "The latter not only helped Bose to become a Japanese citizen, but adopted him into his family when Bose married one of Toyama's followers. The ex-Indian terrorist became an agent for the Japanese and helped to found the Pan-Asiatic League. This movement was closely linked with the Black Dragon and the Great East Asian Co-Prosperity Project. In all these, Bose played a considerable role. However, Bose was obviously too old for all the work involved in these organizations, and though he worked for the Japanese from Bangkok during World War II, he was eventually succeeded by his namesake, Subhas Chandra Bose, another anti-British Indian the Japanese lured away from Berlin. A similar anti-colonial pro-Japanese body created by the Japanese was the Aryan Army, headed by Raja Mahendra Pratap, P-R-A-T-A-P. This was ultimately taken over by the Indian Independence League of East Asia, which was another of Rash Bahari Bose's brainchildren. And the latter died early in 1945. So these two Bose Indian nationalists, or ultra-nationalists, fascists actually, as we're going to see in just a couple of minutes, are affiliated with the Black Dragon Society. First we have Rash Bahari Bose, who flees to Japan after working against the British, is practically adopted by Mitsuru Toyama, who provides him with a wife. He then goes to work with the Black Dragon Society and Japanese intelligence, preparing for World War II, works for Japan in Bangkok during World War II, and his activities on the Indian subcontinent are basically adopted or co-opted by his successor named Subhas Chandra Bose. Is that name S-U-B-H-A-S-C-H-A-N-D-R-A, last name B-O-S-E. So recall the two Boses, Raj Bihari and Subhas Chandra Bose, both Indian ultranationalists who sought help from fascist Japan in their struggle against the British. And recall, again, their links to the Black Dragon Society, the most important of the patriotic societies, and we've already looked at their connections to the Moonies.
And as we'll see later, the Bose connections extend not only to Japan, but to other places, too, and we'll follow up on that. Okay, this is an article that was originally, we read this on One Step Beyond. However, we're going to reread it because it fits right into what we're talking about. This is from the Sunday, August 15th, 1982 edition of the San Jose Mercury News. The headline is Ananda Marga, a deadly mix of yoga, violence, question mark. Subheading is a cult active on the peninsula says its goals are humanitarian, but others link it to killings around the world. It's by Bernard Bauer, a staff writer for the Mercury.